The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the program director here. And as usual, before we start, if you would just turn off your cell phones, hair dryers, unwrap all the cellophane now. It'll make everybody so much happier. And please join us upstairs after the interview for a book signing. This evening I get to introduce Carlin, who will introduce Ion. Carlin Romano is the longtime literary critic of The Inquirer and critic at large of the Chronicle of Higher Education. He also teaches philosophy and media theory at the University of Pennsylvania and was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. Some of you may remember that he wrote two articles about Ion Hirsi Ali last year, in addition to his review of Infidel Today. So he's been following her remarkable story for quite a while. Please welcome Carlin Romano.
Thank you. I'm astonished that we have a sellout, apparently, and it's very crowded upstairs, and I think that's just great because I know you have some of the basic detail about Ion in your programs there. I think she is one of the bravest women in the world, and her books are actually good, too. Really, no struggle reading these books. This book in particular, for those of you who, like me, read The Caged Virgin last year, which was more about her work in the Netherlands, this book really takes her back to birth, to Somalia, to the other countries she grew up in. And I'm not going to waste a lot of your time giving you detail that you have in the program, because I think every minute you get of her is worth it. So please welcome Ion Hirsi Ali. I am on the right, she's on the left. Please note. We're going to have a conversation up here for about 30 minutes, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. And I thought one useful way to do this would be to take Ion through her book and her life a bit. A lot of this book is autobiographical. I read it in the last week, and I could not put it down. I really could not. I don't use cliches like that in my writing, but I'll use it on stage. Because the amount of detail and the wonderful chronological flow of it really keeps you reading. Then I'm going to ask Ion some questions about her activities in Holland, her thinking about Islam, how it's developed. And if we have a few minutes, I might ask her some personal questions too. So, one of the things that you learn very quickly in the book is that you moved around a lot in your early years. Born in Somalia, then Ion went to Saudi Arabia, then to Ethiopia, then to Kenya. And I wonder if you could capsulize a little bit for people when you think back what each of those places really meant to you, how they formed you. Because it certainly comes across in the book that they had an impact.
Where do I begin? Living in Somalia, my mother country, that's where I was born. I remember the sand, and I remember I remember a certain innocence. I also remember, and I try to explain in the book, deaths, even though I'm not yet the age where children understand what death is. In Somalia, before age 8, detect that there's a difference in the treatment of men and women, and I can detect that in the fact that my brother gets more favors from my mother and my grandmother than my sister and I get. But this is all very relative. When I attend Quran school in Mogadishu, Somalia, it's mixed, boys and girls. When I go fast to school, my classmates are boys as well. I remember the dictatorship, even though I didn't know what the term dictator meant. He was explained to us as Afwene, the one with the big mouth. He was a man who jailed my father. He had killed people, and he was bad. And we sat under the tree in front of our house, and we prayed for my father to be released. So those are my early memories. Then I move on to Saudi Arabia. And for the first time, I see people of a different color. And I see that people are different, even though they look like us. They have hands and legs, and but they have a different color. The women are covered completely on the streets, so much so that my sister and I start to joke around and say, hey, look, when they remove their hand to get hold of a child, look, they've got hands. Because we see that the front side and the back side, the way they are veiled, we can't tell the difference. We see in Saudi Arabia, we are told men have their place and women have their place. It was a concept that I was used to. It's just that in Saudi Arabia, it was very, very literal. It starts in the house where you have a section for women and a section for men, in public transport. My father takes my brother with him to all his meetings. Saudi Arabia is where I first meet my father. He doesn't take us with him, and when we ask him that, he says, well, these are, sometimes he says these are the Saudi laws, sometimes he says this has been ordained by God. On Fridays, every Friday, my brother comes back with very exciting stories of executions, people's heads being cut off, women being stoned, people's hands being cut off. I'm not sure if he really saw them, but that was usual. Every after Friday prayer, there were the executions and the physical punishments. And then we are deported from, gratefully deported from Saudi Arabia. And the only person who's unhappy about this is my mother. And we go to Ethiopia. And my first memories of Ethiopia were relief. Suddenly, my sister and I could play outside. We didn't have to cover our hair. There were other children. We could be children again, in a way. And in another way, we were not children. We were exposed to war and death. My father was with the SSDF, Somali Salvation Democratic Front, opposing the Siad Barre regime, and men came to volunteer to fight against Siad Barre, the president of Somalia at the time. And so people who would be sitting with us, eating with us, talking to us, telling us stories, would not come back, and I would see my mother being very sad, and then she would say, well, this man is killed. A man with all his limbs would go and come back, and then we'd see they'd come back without legs, and it was all the first, the first meeting with war, the first introduction to war and the ravages of war. And then we move on to Kenya, and we get on. And in Kenya, I think it was my first country of there was no multiculturalism, but a multicultural country. It's there that I meet very many different tribes of Kenyans, many Pakistanis, Indians. Even white people, when we go to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, we meet people from all over Africa, Rwandans, Burundis, and the term refugee gets a meaning. And we are refugees, and all the people that we meet at the UNHCR buildings are refugees, and all other people are normal. Mm-hmm. And I can go on and on, but I think you better read the book.
It gives you an idea. Yeah. One of the things that struck me, I remember when I read your book, last year, I guess a lot of my assumption about your turn to enlightenment thinking and rational thinking was that most of it happened in Holland. And yet, it does seem to me when I read about your father and your mother that your mother was a devout Muslim. You say at one point in the book that she didn't like the word why, but your father liked the word why. And your father, even though later, we'll get to that, is involved in the arranged marriage or the forced marriage, your father does seem to have been a symbol for you of free thinking of a certain sort. I mean, am I reading that right? That at least early on, your father was a counterweight to your mother? And
I think you're reading right in the sense that my father did encourage the question why. He was far more lenient than my mother. But it would be wrong to think that he was not operating within the clan system. Mm-hmm. He's a clan member. He's a Muslim, a devout Muslim too. And I noticed that difference. I noticed that difference when he comes back in 1990, 1991, mm-hmm. when I realized that I have changed because of my time in Kenya, because of being in touch with the Kenyans, because of being touched by the West through the books that I have read, the movies, and that. He had, in his years in Ethiopia with other Somalis, had become deeply entrenched in his clan thinking, and in fact had become more devout as a Muslim. I don't know if that comes across in the book, but he's had his own development. But he does, at a very young age, insist that my sister and I not be mutilated. He insists that we attend school. He encourages the question why. It does not drive him crazy. It drives my mother crazy. Mm-hmm. And in that, he's been instrumental, perhaps, in laying the foundations for my why, and also in encouraging curiosity. And I think curiosity is a universal trait. All children crawl and touch everything and put it in their mouth. Mm-hmm. And my father was the man who would encourage that, even if it was to her detriment. Mm-hmm. And my mother was afraid of it. She was afraid of the questions. She was afraid of the answers. She had rules, and they were very clear, and that's the way God wanted them. There was halal and there was haram. This is right. That's wrongful, and there was no need beyond that to ask questions. You could only ask, what is halal and what is haram, but not beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you read Infidel, which I hope you will, you'll see that Ayan was a troublemaker in quite innocent, childish ways, also ringing doorbells and running away and things like that. One thing I don't believe a lot of people still
We didn't
know.
Have toys.
Right. That's right.
We had a lot of energy. Uh-huh. We didn't have toys, and there was a lot of time. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to excuse it, but
see, I think a lot of people still don't realize that you went through your own phase of being enamored with Islam, which began really in Kenya. Can you talk a little bit about that, the teacher that kind of drew you into that, and describe yourself a bit when you were most excited about Islam? And
This is around 1985, 1986. I'm not quite sure which, but I remember it was either in the end of Form 2 or the beginning of Form 3, and then I would have been around 15 or 16 years of age. And before that, I had actually never thought about, and I think no one around me had thought about whether we were Muslims or not. We were Muslims. That's just how it was. And then this young, very charismatic woman comes to us. She's beautiful. She's got this heart-shaped face, and she's very, very pale. And she would probably be less white than you, but at the time, everyone around us was black, so we saw her to be very white. And so the contrast between the black garment she's wearing and her skin color, I mean, I can still recall it. And then she asks us during IRE class, Islamic Religious Education class, which before her was very boring. It was about trying to relate when was Islam founded, who founded it, the four caliphs and the dates, and it was pretty much an extension of history class. And she changes that. She never makes us open the textbooks. She does not stick to the curriculum given by the school. But in small work groups, she tells us, I want you to tell me, if you are a Muslim, put up your hand. And we are puzzled by that. We are all Muslims, otherwise we would not be taking an IRE class. And then she says, so we all put up our hands, and then she looks at one and the other and says, so how do I know you are a Muslim? What distinguishes you from non-Muslims? We are still puzzled. And then she says, do you pray five times a day? When was the last time you prayed? And, you know, we all kind of smile shyly and giggle and, well, I don't know when was the last time I prayed. And your hair is uncovered, even though you have already gone beyond the age of menstruation. And so slowly she takes us back into the commandments. And that is And the way she also talked, she was very charismatic. She wouldn't say like my mother, this is haram and that's halal. And she would just say, this is what God wants you to do and it is up to you. It's your own choice. Here are the consequences. So I found myself, after a year in her hands, covering myself, trying to pray the 5 times a day, being a real Muslim, distinguishing myself from other non-Muslims, and in fact going on to the next step, which is da'wah, which is try and tell the other kids who are not Muslim, but we are in the same school, and those who are not observant Muslims, tell them about the good word, spread the word. So we had become literally little missionaries in our own schools. And it's just after that that she introduces us to what is the meaning of jihad. And jihad, the struggle, the inner jihad, is that you observe the rules. You pray the 5 times a day. You obey your parents. You know, you obey all the rules of God. You, instead of cheating during the month of Ramadan, where I would fast for 5 days and then not fast for 5 days and then fast again, it would be, you know, try and take it all the way through. And then after that comes the external jihad, which is, as a Muslim, you can't passively only be a Muslim. There are enemies of Islam. And the enemies of Islam were defined as the Jews and the Christians, and from her we got magazines, colorful magazines of men, lots of them dead. And it was at the time during the Iraqi and Iranian war, and this was Iranian propaganda telling us about, look what the Americans and the Jews are doing to the Muslims. And Sister Aziza did not expect us to take arms and go to Iran and fight there, but during every prayer to pray for them, for the martyrs who stood up for Islam. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much the introduction. Yeah.
And then as the book takes us through Ayan's life, you go back to Mogadishu, and then in your early 20s, I'm not sure if you would agree with this, I know you've said often that your real turn as a critic of Islam comes in 2001, but then there's that interesting time when you're back there and you're dating an imam, and you begin to get a sense of hypocrisy. Yes. Do you want to tell a little bit of that story?
That's the sort of story I'd really like that people read about it themselves.
Uh-huh. Just thought I might be able to tease this story out on stage.
I think in hindsight that if I had grown up in the West and I was exposed to as much questioning and critical thinking, I might have become an infidel much earlier. But at the time, I went into, after leaving Sister Aziza in 1989, I go to Somalia and I meet a remarkable young man called Abshir. His father was killed after he had freed my father from prison. His father was a prison director in the early 1970s. So there's also this just this romantic aura. He and I meeting, he and I falling in love. He and I going to marry after his father had saved my father. That was all very, very exciting. He belongs and says he is a member of the Brotherhood, the Islamic Brotherhood, Akhwan al-Muslimun. This is not an organization, but it's a movement. And when he and I are together, we do what all young adults do, which is stare deeply into each other's eyes for hours, touch and kiss and make out, but he's an imam, and I come to Somalia wearing Sister Aziza's coat. We call it a coat, so the covering, you know, leaving the face and the hands uncovered, but the rest of me is covered in black. And he declares that garment, which in the eyes of people living in Kenya is very extreme, he declares that to be not good enough. So he has me covering myself in a garment which is of the same material, of almost denims, just less in brown and dark, and I have to cover my face. And it's very, very hot in Mogadishu. It's 35 degrees Celsius. So we go through all this. I'm confused about it. There's the whole logic of this doesn't make sense, you know, what we do in the private time. And also I start to think, if God has created me and he's created me perfectly, why do I have the desire to sin? because making out is, of course, sinful. Why can't he just give me a body that doesn't react to it? That's just antisexual. And we are not supposed to question God as Muslims. We only submit to his will. And what Abshir does is, especially on the Fridays when he is on duty, he not only leads the prayer, but he gives lectures afterwards in which he denounces temptation, premarital sex, the whole thing. And at the end of it, he comes and makes it out with me. And so I'm completely, I'm filled with guilt and I'm dazed by it all. And I tell him at one point, I think it's just, I can't deal with it. And then I say from one day to the next, it's over. That's by my brother who had tried to warn me and to say, you know, don't get involved with this guy. Then describes my behavior when I turn him down, says, you know, this is typical female behavior. One day they say A, the next day they say B. This is exactly why God doesn't want, God has decided that their testimony is worth half that of the male. So in my behavior I see, my brother sees the argument of why we women are just worth half men.
So probably the most famous act in your life and certainly the most momentous for you was when you did decide not to go ahead with a forced marriage and go to Canada, and then decided you were in Germany, decided you were going to go to the Netherlands and escape to the Netherlands. Was that decision something that just happened in a moment? You suddenly, the courage welled up and you decided to do it? Was it very carefully thought out over a period of time? Can you describe that a little?
I think what was thought out over a long period of time was the idea that I was going to leave Osman Musa. I was going to sabotage the marriage. And at first I thought, you know, I'll go to Canada and then once there I'm just going to behave in a terrible way. He'll not want me. I'll behave in a way he's not going to want me for his wife. But then I also thought of the risk of getting pregnant, which had happened. I had seen it around me all the time, that if you become a wife and you really become a wife, you sleep with him and then you get pregnant and so you're stuck with a baby. And I didn't think that was a good idea. So I had been thinking, but I had no answer yet. And coming to Germany, and this opportunity that seemed to, you know, very coincidental, but seemed to have fallen from heaven, I thought, well, this is the place to do it. Because the immediate social control. My father was not with me. My husband was not with me. My brother was not with me. This distant uncle of mine had decided to take me to another distant cousin of ours in Bonn. So he wasn't watching over me. There was no more he. And it was at that point that I thought, hey, I can leave. And I called my aunt, distant aunt, who had stayed in our house as a refugee, and said, I'm coming to visit you. And I didn't tell her on the telephone what I intended to do. And it was after I went to see her that I thought, if she can escape, I too can escape. And she didn't escape from the family. She didn't escape. What she did was, as a woman on her own, she was in Holland with four children and pregnant. Didn't speak the language, hadn't lived outside Somalia before. And if she could do that, I could manage to do that.
As many of you know, to telescope it a little bit, in the future, Ayan then works her way up, you might say, in Dutch society, goes to the University of Leiden, studies political science, works as an interpreter for the immigration service, translating between Dutch and Somali, begins to learn, right, about the immigrant communities and the Muslim communities in the Netherlands. And I guess what really catapulted you, put you in everybody's viewfinder, is that horrible murder of Theo van Gogh after you made the film Submission. I think a lot of us, you know, have read about that. What we might not know as much as what, aside from, I'm sure, the great sorrow of such a terrible act, when that happened, did it suddenly force you to think, what am I doing? Can I keep doing this? Can I keep being the critic I have been? Do I owe it to him to keep going? What was your reaction about what your future was going to be when that heinous act took place?
Well, I owe it to him to keep going, to start with. And before that, between 1992 and 2001, I wasn't involved in politics. I wasn't involved in any... I hadn't developed any serious ideas about the world. I was full of questions as to why, yes, we Muslims, you know, the chosen ones, we were coming in large numbers to countries like Holland, the countries of the infidels, and so on. But I had no... I was completely absorbed with my own survival. I had, coming, being in Holland for the first time, noticed that a state can really be benevolent, that they can take care of you. They gave me a place to sleep. They gave me food. I got a permanent residence. I got help. And I didn't understand, if I only looked at my experience of other governments in the past, government either in Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya, these were governments that subjugated their own peoples, that oppressed people, that put people in jail without trial, that tortured people, cut off hands and so on. So this, the whole idea was put, the Dutch government is like a mother and like a father to you. And they give you money and they ask you, how are you? And if even if you can't find a job, they send you to a psychologist or a psychotherapist and they ask you how you're doing. So there's this, yeah, there's this, this government that cuddles me. And so this is all, well, how did this come about? I'm fascinated by Dutch history. But that was it. There wasn't really more to it. After the 11th of September, then the question is posed, is it Islamic or is it not Islamic? Western leaders say, appeal to Muslims, please stand up and say this is not done in the name of my religion. Bin Laden, on the other hand, appeals to Muslims and says, stand up, it's jihad time, we are fighting our enemies. So as a Muslim in 2001, if you were aware, if you were following these events, you could not be neutral. You had to take a position. And working for a political party, a think tank of a political party, I had just completed political science. I had no excuse to say, you know, this doesn't, I don't want to have anything to do with any of this. I started to think about it and came to the conclusion it is Islamic, Islam as I was taught, Islam as is in the Quran, in the Hadith, and I started to speak up. And I thought at the time, in... because we were addressing this issue within Holland and only in the Dutch context. And it was, how can we help Muslim immigrants integrate? The word assimilate is not used in Holland, only in negative terms, but integrate into Dutch society. And my answer to that was through education, a different kind of education than we Muslims got from home, and then through women. If we liberate the women, and by liberation I meant helping them finish their school, ensuring that they finish school, becoming financially independent, and becoming sexually independent. If we achieved that in Holland, the next generation of Muslims will be integrated. We won't have problems with that. And so what is the obstacle? Why is it that Muslim women in a wealthy country like the Netherlands are not integrating? And I say that has to do with their religion, their culture, their habits and customs. And that's what started the whole problem. And Theo van Gogh helped with that. And not only did he make the movie, but even before that, he had always pointed out to these, to the way the treatment of women in Islam, even before I came on the scene. Then he was killed. And he could be killed because he had no protection from the state. He had protection only for 4 days after we made submission. They could not kill me because I had protection. And yes, I do, in hindsight, owe it to him. And in fact, during his cremation, his funeral, his mother said, make sure that his name is never forgotten. And I've pledged it to her. Mm-hmm. I'll make sure his name is never forgotten.
For those of you who don't know this story, when Theo van Gogh was killed, he was shot. and then he was stabbed and almost decapitated, and as he was stabbed, the person who killed him stabbed a note onto his chest, right, that said, "You would be next."
Yes. Which was in a way revealing, because the guy who killed Theo van Gogh later during the trial, his trial, Theo van Gogh at the time was accused of, he had called Muslims goat fuckers. He had called Jewish people living in Holland all sorts of names. He had provoked everyone, and he had been provoking everyone for 15 years. And just after he was murdered, there were many people who said it's because he called them goat fuckers and because he offended the Moroccans. And his killer said, "No, it has nothing to do with him calling me this, and I'm not offended in the least. It's because God tells me to kill anyone who insults him or the prophet. And that is what Theo van Gogh did. And if it were my brother, I would kill him too." And I think that's much more telling than, and that's the adversity, the kind of enemy we face, than all the, you know, Theo van Gogh was provocative. And as if you would kill someone or you would condone the killing of someone because of being offensive.
So certainly in the years after that, 2004 to last year, you became even more controversial in the Netherlands. You had various disputes about your situation there. You had been in the parliament. You eventually left the parliament. And for those of you who don't know, Ayaan came to live in the United States in September, is now with the American Enterprise Institute there. I guess it's only 6 or 7 months, but when you look back at your Dutch time now, you've been in a number of different countries. You are a Dutch citizen, I think, still. What do you think of Dutch culture as a result of your experience there? I mean, do you miss it? Did it have an enormous importance for you? Do you feel like you still want to talk to the Dutch people?
I love Holland and I love the Dutch people, and I am forever grateful for the fact that I could not have become who I have become. I could not have found my freedom without Holland and without the help of the Dutch people and my Dutch friends. And I am now saying the Dutch friends, but I have become a Dutch citizen, and fortunately I've retained my Dutch citizenship. And it could not have happened without their help. Yes, there was a huge amount of controversy between my thoughts and the way a number of Dutch people think about the question of immigration, Islam, integration. But even after that had taken place, the Dutch had put me in the parliament. They debated with me. When I got threatened, the Dutch government provided protection, still is providing protection. So there is no, I have absolutely no animosity towards Holland or the Dutch. There are individuals with whom I agree and individuals with whom I disagree. And I think that they have one of the most, probably the most liberal culture in the world. Mm-hmm. And I am worried about Holland because I think that it's that culture of freedom, that culture of live and let live, is under threat. Mm-hmm. After 1945, the Dutch population is not familiar with religious intolerance. I mean, not at the level that it is taking place now in. And the generation after 1945, and it's not only Holland, it's also the other European countries, have taken all of the freedoms that they have very much for granted, because these are the generations that have inherited these freedoms and have not gone about establishing these freedoms. So it's extremely important to stay wary. And I think that Islam is a threat to Holland. Mm-hmm. And I make a distinction between Islam as a doctrine and Muslims on the other. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that Muslims are a threat to Holland. I'm saying Islam as a doctrine is. And the only way that the Dutch and the other Europeans can deal with it is by recognizing that it is opposed and incompatible mm-hmm. with the freedoms that the Dutch hold dear, and trying to teach, persuade Muslim individuals who have migrated from elsewhere and the children of Muslim parents to accept and cherish the same freedoms, the freedom of expression, the freedom to move. You know, the governments of where we come from, That's my message again and again. These are governments that have exploited us, whether it's in the name of Islam or in the name of elsewhere. And if the Dutch were only to succeed in making every individual Muslim see why the fundamental principles of their own state, of the open society, is valuable, then we would have achieved something. I don't know. I'm very worried. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Before we have a few minutes still before we open it up, and I wanted to ask Ayaan some critical questions about her work and her positions, because I think now as a lot of attention is coming to this new book in particular, certain factions are developing certain attitudes in the reviews of her book and so on. One question that has been asked is that if you are such a great supporter of Muslim women in the Netherlands, why don't we hear more voices from those women in your support? Some people in the reviews had said, why are you such a lonely voice? I think there are answers to that, but I'd like to hear your answer.
Well, my first answer is I've never sought a following. My aim is to generate doubt, to disturb, to provoke. When I made submission, what I realized before and while thinking about submission was, in Holland we were talking about the emancipation of women and the emancipation of Muslim women. And I wondered, emancipation from what? Here is a government and a people, and they are over-providing for these people. Please come and have an education. Please come and learn the Dutch language. Please, we will help you find a job. So the emancipation we were talking about was one which was within the culture and within the context of Islam. And then I realized, thinking about it more than that, that it wasn't only, I had translated for women who would say, who are beaten by their husbands, who would leave, or at least the Dutch authorities would help them leave that husband, put them in women's shelters. And then once in such a shelter, the woman would go back with the argument, I have to remain obedient to my husband. I may suffer on this earth, but God will reward me in the hereafter. And I thought, first and foremost, when we talk about emancipation or liberation, it has to be from that mindset. It has to be from that concept of a God to whom you submit, who tells you that you have to suffer on this earth so that you can be rewarded in the hereafter. Mm-hmm. I could do that because I had gone through my own emancipation, in which I had, at least for myself, acknowledged there is no hereafter. So my aim is not so much to say, I need all these women to follow me. They don't need to follow me. Each and every single woman has to make her own decision. But what I want to do is make her aware of this. Mm-hmm. It's God who tells you, and it's very painful. The same God who says a disobedient wife should be beaten is the same God to whom Muslim women run for comfort. It's this that women have to become aware. This is very philosophical. This is very, very basic. It's not about getting a following. And I've never wanted to do that. And I'm not, I've never been a proponent of, I'm very suspicious of people who say that they want to have a following.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect of your work that makes you very distinctive, it seems to me, and I get scores to hundreds of books about Islam in the course of a season, is that whereas so many people in American life, from the president down, have said things like, well, Islam itself is a loving, kind religion. It's only these distorters of Islam who are our enemies. You have said that there are fundamental problems with Islam as a religion, going back to the Prophet Muhammad, going back to his behavior and so on. And that has only further incited people against you. The idea that, okay, let's look at Muhammad. Let's see how he lived, what he did. When you reflect on that, do you still stick to your guns on that, and that Islam itself has to be looked at in its very core beliefs? It's not a fringe problem. The problem is in the core beliefs?
Yes. When I was educated in Holland, I was educated in Leiden as a political scientist. What we would do is we would take the theory of someone and we would say, let's look at what this person is saying. This set of beliefs, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Marxism, whether it's Nazism, what is this person trying to tell us? We would look at the set of beliefs, how consistent they were, what was the worldview of this, you know, liberalism, conservatism, socialism. We would look at this. And that is my approach towards Islam. And Islam tells us the individual must submit wholly his will to Allah. And we know this through the Prophet Muhammad, who is the only person to have ever communicated with God through the angel Gabriel. That's called the revelation, and it's the Quran. And the Quran tells us that human beings, every individual, must follow a certain set of rules, the halal and the haram, or refrain from, you know, follow the halal rules, that what is permitted, refrain from that what is forbidden. If you live your life like that, in the hereafter, there's going to be a day of judgment, and God will judge you and either send you to heaven or send you to hell. My assertion is that this is opposed to secular liberalism. I mean, liberalism is secular, but liberalism and secular societies and the fundamental principles on which this society is based. Islam holds that women are subordinate to men, that gays should be killed, that infidels should either be persuaded to become Muslims or killed. Only the people of the book, Christians and Jews, can be exempted from being converted to Islam, but that is only after they pay a particular tax and agree to a set of rules as living subordinates within the Islamic doctrine. Islam covers the social, the cultural, the political, and the military side of life. So Islam as a doctrine, if you compare it, if you put it next to secular liberal doctrine on which the open society is based, you'll see that that is incompatible. That's not being radical, that is not being, you know, hostile, it's just stating an obvious fact.
No, I'm just going to ask two. I'm going to leave out the personal questions. Maybe I'll ask her that later. I have two theoretical questions I want to ask you that have come up increasingly in the reviews. One is this, it seems to me, growing attempt to pigeonhole you, to position you as a kind of absolutist atheist. The phrase has been used, I think maybe it started with Timothy Garton-Ash, the Oxford historian, an Enlightenment fundamentalist. And the notion seems to be, well, at one time she was a devout Muslim, now she swung all the way over to the other side, and she can't see anything good in religion. All she can see is atheism, which is absolutely correct, and so on. It seems to me that you're being reduced, stereotyped. What do you think of these images that are coming out of you in the reviews?
All I can say is respond to that and say I'm not an absolutist in any of that. I have no trouble with religion, be it Christianity, Islam, Judaism, or something else, as long as those who adhere to that particular religion do not find an excuse in their religion to take away the freedoms of others. My particular problem with Islam is that a father would argue. Another time I was living in Holland, that's what we were looking at. Why were fathers removing their daughters early on from school? Why were they transporting them to Morocco or Turkey and marrying them off? Where did they get this excuse to kill their daughters? And the perpetrators would use religious argument to say, to argue why they took away the freedom of their child. Or why, like in the sense of Mohamed Bouyeri, why he killed Theo van Gogh. That sort of religion and that understanding of religion is extremely dangerous. It can start very small, but almost always grows to be very big unless it's challenged. And all I'm doing it is challenging it.
And my last question will be this. There's a lot of talk about reform of Islam, that Islam has to go through a type of reform that Christianity went through and that some would argue Judaism went through. And yet others think that perhaps you put the principles of Islam in such an extreme form that you would not be able to accept the idea that it could be reformed without abandoning some of the fundamental principles. Now, we all know in the major religions, you have sacred texts, and then you have the people who live more or less according to these sacred texts. There's no question that Christianity and Catholicism have developed in ways that don't resemble, say, the Crusade period today. Do you believe that Islam can be reformed in a way that you could look at it and think, it's a perfectly nice little religion?
To start with, it's far from little. Muslims can reform their religion if they start with the word reform. To reform means to acknowledge that there's something wrong and then change that. I believe that for those Muslims who are seriously interested in reforming their faith, that they have to acknowledge to start with that the Quran is not written or revealed by God, but it's written by human beings. Once you acknowledge that, then you can go into the content of the Quran and say, those commands in the Quran that urge the believer to kill or to in any way take away the freedoms of others can then be changed, replaced, or at least read in their context. If you continue to say the Quran is the word of God and the concept for a Muslim is only submission to the will of God, it's not a God that you argue with, it's not a God that you have a dialogue with, then I don't see how that can be reformed. So yes, start with saying, I'm going to have a dialogue with God, acknowledge that there's something wrong with the content of the Quran, and then change it. The next point would be to acknowledge that the Prophet Muhammad, as a human being, if he ever lived and if he ever existed, is that he's not infallible. The Prophet Muhammad is a model. He's a guide to all Muslims all over the world, regardless of time. It's not only in the 6th century, but in the 21st century, he's still seen by 1.2 billion people to be their example. And so, yes, we have to investigate, scrutinize the morality of the Prophet Muhammad. And if we take human rights as a yardstick, what you see is a lot of the things that the Prophet said and in many ways that the Prophet behaved, it's contrary to that. So you acknowledge that that is how the Prophet behaved, and then we say we're going to reform that. Next, the sexual morality. I mean, the relationship between the man and the woman in the Islamic doctrine is pathological. The man is never trained as from boyhood onwards to control his sexual urges. It's only the woman who's either confined to the home or covered up, and she is responsible for whether he gets aroused or not. Premarital sex, like all monotheistic religions in Islam, is prohibited. But the punishment that follows almost always affects the woman because she has to prove if she is raped with four witnesses. Why would four witnesses watch a rape? She has to come with four witnesses to say that she's been raped. So that sort of sexuality, the whole virginity doctrine and the penalties that go with it, that has to be reformed. And one of the most important obstacles to the reformation of Islam as opposed, for example, to Catholicism is the lack of organization. In Sunni Islam, we are all equal in front of God. So if you get a following and you decide to change and reform parts of, as we can see some Muslims do today, then someone else will stand up and say, but your authority is nonsense, and besides, you're not taking the Quran literally. I have a better idea. And so the other one has got another following, and then it becomes complete chaos. So taking this great obstacle of lack of organization, lack of a hierarchy within Islam into consideration, and then these three main reasons, I think that the way to reformation is extremely difficult, but if the adherents are determined, they could.
No question, the reform agenda is large. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
I, I'm sure you understand if you had no competition in asking her questions, you'd be asking her questions yourself all night and never stop. So please remember that there are mics going around and speak into the mic. And who has a question? How about right here? We'll start in the first row.
Hi. I just wanted to push a little bit further on that last topic that was being discussed. And in particular, just to ask a little bit more about the reasons why to reform Islam there would need to be a recognition that of some of the things that were discussed about the problems with the Quran, because it seems to me that Christianity and Judaism have gone through those types of reforms without the adherents of those faiths saying, you know what, the Old Testament is wrong. It simply is, it seems to me to be an issue of making it compatible with liberalism and secularism in a society to say, well, we're going to interpret it in this different way. And it seems that you're saying that Islam can't do that, that there that additional steps need to be taken.
I'm not saying Islam can or cannot do that. Islam is basically a set of ideas. It's not an actor. It's not a human being. It'll do none of that. It can't take action. But there are Muslims who have an interest in the status quo, who derive power from Islam. Look at the Saudi government. They're not interested in change. Or most of them, those with power and who derive their power, base their power on Islam, don't want to change those basic tenets. They don't want to say that there's something wrong with the religion. The Brotherhood movement, who also, even though it's a grassroots movement, they still derive the power that they have from a literal reading of the Quran. And also, they are not interested in change. There are other individuals who say, you know what, we do want to welcome modernity, and we have. And this has been going on ever since Islam was founded, asking of questions and saying, you know, let's adapt the religion as we go to the circumstances that we find ourselves in. But those individuals, almost always few in number, the dissidents, the free thinkers, have been faced with the adversity of either being shunned or killed. Their books have been banned. And that is, I think, one of the main differences between the Islamic world and, say, the Christian world, that the free thinkers within the Christian world have found a way to outmaneuver the people who have who derive their power from the status quo. Most famous for this is, of course, the Catholic Church. Banning books, but because of the discovery of the printing press, people could still think and write and spread their ideas, even though they faced persecution from the church. And I think one of the, terrible misfortunes of Islam is, as there is no church, and as every Muslim individual is required to act the church, it becomes increasingly difficult not only to write down your ideas, but also to spread them. However, now having the internet and living in the information age, it should be easier for Muslims to do that. And I think that what you see these days is, I've read and watched in Berlin 120 Muslims who said, we resign from Islam, and they've established the Council of Ex-Muslims, which is amazing, because in the 21st century, first of all, you're calling a press conference and actually getting press to say that you no longer belong to a faith. But these are, I think, the signs of hope, I would say, to those Muslims who are interested in a true reformation of their faith or in true change, that they can take advantage of the information age to spread those ideas without being killed.
The questions, how about over there?
I think people need to actually see you to realize what a straight-talking, courageous woman you are, and I really appreciate that. My question is a little bit tangential, but I want to ask it anyhow. Since it was stated that you are working with the American Enterprise, Association, which everybody knows is a pretty strong right-wing political organization. I'm curious about how you came to them and what you're doing there and what they're doing with you. I would like to hear how somebody with your ideas and personality reconciles that.
Let me first tell you about how I came to the American Enterprise Institute. In 2005, it was in August, a good friend and an old ambassador of the United States to the Netherlands, appointed by Bill Clinton in his time, had taken me. I told her that I wanted to finish my term as a member of parliament until 2007, and that I was looking for a job pretty much, either with a university or with a think tank. And she said, if you come to Washington then and then, it was in August, I'll take you to the various think tanks that are there and the universities. And she took me to Georgetown University. They wanted me, but they didn't have enough money, and they had to go through the whole bureaucracy. She took me to the Brookings Institute, and the Brookings Institute, the guy who talked to us, said, well, you know, we've just started this program called the Doha Institute in Qatar. And, you know, taking into account what you said about the Prophet Muhammad, and then I knew exactly what this meant. It meant for the Brookings Institute, either me or the Doha Institute. She took me to the RAND Corporation, who said we only have researchers. And researchers are very much into statistics, and that's absolutely not my strong side. And then we went to the Johns Hopkins, and they said at the time they didn't have enough money, but they would take the time to get the money. And then Cynthia Schneider said, I'm going to take you to my friend, Norm Ornstein. He is with the American Enterprise Institute. And I shrieked, and I said, no. And then she told me, you know what? Many Europeans are prejudiced about the U.S. And I will demonstrate to you that there is more prejudice about this institution than that there really is. Norm Ornstein is a very good friend of Bill Clinton's, and you should come and see him. And I said, they're going to make me convert into Christianity. I've just... And she said, come on, don't be silly. Let's go and see them if you don't like them. And so she took me there, and I think within 15 minutes or half an hour of meeting me, Norm and his colleague, Caroline Baumann, said, we need you to speak to our president. They invited me to come one more time to speak to a set of scholars. And I told them, they said, we want to have you. And I said, are you going to convert me into Christianity? And he was, no. I am an atheist. Is that okay to be an atheist? Yes. I am pro-euthanasia, pro-gay marriages, pro-abortion. Does all that matter? Nope, it didn't matter. Why? Because there were individuals, and still are individuals, within the American Enterprise Institute who have, on all matters, whether it is on the social policy or ethics or economic policy, who hold completely different views. And the president, Chris DeMuth, said, we admire controversy, we welcome controversy. Because we think by disagreeing with each other, we can learn from one another, and we can teach each other. And they haven't disappointed me ever since. What am I doing? Yeah. Thank you very much. What am I doing right now at the American Enterprise Institute? I'm working on a book called Shortcut to Enlightenment, where I wake up the Prophet Muhammad in the New York Public Library, and I have him have a conversation with Karl Popper, with Friedrich Hayek, and with John Stuart Mill on women. And I don't think I would have been able to do a project like this one with the Brookings. And so I think the question that everyone keeps asking me, how come that you are a liberal with a conservative institute, I would say, That must make liberals uncomfortable. That's a question that should be put to liberals. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There's a hand there right in the middle. Yeah, you. Mm-hmm. By the way, her book is like this. You know, a question comes up, she gives you the answer.
Straight away. Yeah.
In detail.
Thank you.
As a political scientist and as a person who has experienced many different cultures and governments, you made some comments about the Netherlands and how you saw there were some real risks to their freedoms and liberties there. You've now been in the United States for a time period. Do you see risks to liberties and freedoms here in the United States?
I see risks on two levels. On the one hand, I see a risk in finding a balance between preserving civil rights and ensuring that civilians are secure. That's on a state level. How much freedom can the state take away to keep us all secure? I have to confess to you that that debate is far more vibrant, far more alive, far more passionate in the United States than it is anywhere in Europe. But that debate, and it's not only a debate for the United States, it's a debate for the open society in general, is how much freedom can the state take away? How much of our civil liberties can the state take away to guarantee our security? That's one. I see it. I have no answer. I'm looking at them just as puzzled. I'm following it very closely. The second one is, I think, and this is a criticism towards the United States, that Americans seem to think of Islam only as a matter of foreign policy. Unlike Europe, Europe today is struggling to understand and to come to terms with Islam as a matter of domestic policy. And it is a domestic issue. And Americans seem to have deluded themselves in general. Oh, but you know, our American Muslims, they are all they all have a lot of money and they are well assimilated and they have their mosques and we see no problems. And I have my questions on that. Does that sound it?
I think we have time for two questions still. Back there, against the wall. I'm not saying you should be put against the wall. You are next to the wall.
Thank you for sharing some very serious and profound thoughts with us. You might reasonably be accused of being a philosopher. However, you have also run for and succeeded at acquiring political office. And we are now awash in electoral politics. I apologize if this verges upon being a personal question, but I wonder if you might say something to us about having run for electoral office in the Netherlands with all the very serious thoughts that you have shared with us and all of the other things that running for office entails.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of the question. And what is the question?
What it's like to run for office and what is entailed by that.
Yes.
Making a coherent English sentence. Yeah. Expressing a thought which is of some seriousness and at the same time seeking electoral office.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I get it, yes. Being an intellectual or trying to be an intellectual and becoming a politician, as a politician, you need to get into power. You need to persuade voters on all different levels. Being a politician in Holland was easy because we have a proportional system and we have a system whereby we work with lists. So when the party leadership of the Liberal Party in the Netherlands decided to put me into politics, they put me somewhere on the list number 16, in which it was obvious anyway that I was going to be elected, which makes it very different from running for office in the United States, where you really run for office. So that was one. And two, in my case, I had an issue in society that I thought was not being dealt with well enough, and I thought I could do it better than anyone else. And so I went for my issue. That was extremely difficult because politics, not only in the Netherlands, but in the West in general, has become a career. It's something that you get into early, at an early age, and you know, you move on. And that way you compromise. You compromise a lot of, I would say, public interest. And that compromise manifests itself when an individual is faced with either losing office or not being elected, or being honest and completely saying what he or she thinks. That's the major problem today for very many politicians. If you ask me what would I choose, I would say I would stick to my issue. And if I'm not elected, then someone else will be elected, or voters will have to live with the consequences of their choice.
A last question. This has to be the very best question, of course. How about all the way in the back by the door, the woman back there? Yeah, you. Wait for the mic, please.
Thank you for your clarity and your courage. I've been listening to you on all the various shows. My question concerns Theo van Gogh and your film Submission. When Theo van Gogh was murdered, I realized there was a film Submission. I did not know that. I immediately tried to find it and see it. Would you please tell everyone in this audience how they currently can see Submission if they don't know? And also, can you tell me, is it still being circulated in Europe, and if at all circulated in the Middle East? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Can you see Submission? Just after Theo van Gogh was killed, the production company decided to remove it from circulation and not to show it anywhere else because of the threat of violence and because of the reluctance of the government at that time to protect the individuals and the property of the production company. It's been put on internet, and I know many people have told me that they can't see it on internet. I've tried and I can't see it. I have a DVD. You know where you can find it? Okay, well, here is someone who can find it.
Okay. If you can,
I'll repeat it. Yeah.
Okay.
If you go on one of either of two of Irshad Manji's MySpaces, it's either her personal one under her name or one called Project Ishtihad. There are, I don't know the correct terminology, but people connect with them. One woman's name, who was also part of the Secular Islam Conference on March 5th in St. Petersburg and was interviewed on the Glenn Beck Show. I forget her last name. Her first name is Rachel. On her connection, you can see Submission. That's one place you can see it that I found it.
So is it clear?
It's on.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So we're going to stop there. Thank you so much, Ayan, for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.